All right, thanks for sticking with us, folks. Again, you're listening to Church and State with Stephen Cox on Magnificat Radio. And there's been ongoing coverage this week by all in the media about the Pope's apostolic exhortation on the family. And we're seeing, essentially, everyone's cards are being put on the table. We're seeing those who are essentially doing the bidding of Rome, doing the talking points that they've wanted to have follow this document. And we're seeing those who I think are true friends of the Pope, and those who are clarifying and attempting to rectify that which is ambiguous in this document, and really to do the job all Catholics are called to do, and that's to save souls. And I think one of those outlets that's doing this and has been doing this for quite some time is LifeSiteNews.com, who I fully endorse and really recommend that you go to their website. I go to there quite frequently, and so I do recommend that you do as well. And that's what I wanted to have on today to discuss the Pope's document, the media's behavior, and a whole bunch of other issues. The co-founder and editor-in-chief of LifeSiteNews.com, John Henry Weston, who lives in Canada right now with his 8 children and his wife, Diane. John Henry has spoken at countless conferences on the family, works in the pro-life field, and I want to welcome him to Church and State on Magnificat Radio. John, are you there?
I'm here. Great to be with you, Stephen.
Excellent. Thank you for coming on and having the courage, I think, to talk about these things today. Is it going too far to say that this is a revolutionary document that the Pope has published, this Amoris Laetitia?
I don't think it's too far, only because actually the comparison to 1968. You know, it's very interesting. In 68, you had Humanae Vitae.
Mm-hmm.
But the precursor to Humanae Vitae was what we've had now. You had 2 or so years of confusion in the church over the family. And back then, it was over contraception. The majority report came down 2 years previous to Humanae Vitae saying, yes, let's go for it. There was a minority report, of course, issued by Karol Wojtyła that said, you know, stick with the church's teaching. But the point was, over those 2 years, there was massive confusion in the church. You had all of these church priests in confession basically telling people, it's all right now, we're all good.
Right.
And then came the clarification. We had that replayed over the last 2 years with the synods on the family. Confusion over divorce, remarried, communion, over the state of homosexuality in the church, where there could be, you know, things to learn from and gain for it, a positive value in it. And then we were waiting for the answer. And I think a lot of people who historically knew that lead up to 68 were waiting for that final answer. And what came was more confusion. So if that's a revolution, it really is. The worst possible outcome mm-hmm. for this document wasn't heterodoxy.
Right.
It would have been awesome if it was orthodoxy. But ambiguity is actually the worst possible thing it could be.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Humanae Vitae, and I mean, the family, contraception. This reminds me, in the document, and I forget exactly where, it's a very large document, you take forever to read it, I'm not sure if you've read the entire thing, but there is a segment in the document that talks about, the Pope basically says, well, while we can't just focus on procreation for the family, he says, while the family unit and the unity of the family is not just about procreation, it's about love and unity. And, I mean, I commented on this last week, you know, Casti Canubi, all the papal documents before the Second Vatican Council were focusing on the fact that procreation is the primary aim of marriage. And then at the Vatican Council, I forget exactly which document, it might be Gaudium et Spes, basically an equaling of the parts. And then now I think the Pope has kind of flipped that upside down and said, no, it's about unity, it's about love. Did you get that out of this document at all? Did you catch up on that?
I did, absolutely. It points to something very strange. And in order to capture it fully, you have to actually take the words of the document itself. And so I'm actually going to read something to you. This is from the document. This is in paragraph 36, one of the early ones. This section wasn't paid much attention to
right.
in much of the commentary because everybody's focusing on chapter 8, which is admittedly the most controversial chapter.
Sure, sure, yeah.
However, even in the very beginning at paragraph 36, he says this. We often, now this is a direct quote, by the way, we often present marriage in such a way that its unitive meaning, its call to grow in love, and its ideal of mutual assistance are overshadowed by, get this is, again, direct quote, an almost exclusive insistence on the duty of procreation. Okay, now this is very weird. It's weird because that is living in a fantasy world. I'm sorry, I'm 45 years old. I have never, ever in my lifetime seen anybody even imagine that there's any priest out there who says to married couples or to couples preparing for marriage, by the way, it's all about procreation.
Right.
We haven't had that. If it ever was in the church, we haven't had it in 50 years. In fact, Ross Douthat, the famous columnist, was just at a conference called, actually, surprisingly, Is the Pope Catholic? But yep. He made this point. Yep. He said, that's nuts. Mm-hmm. He said, quite literally. Because it's so out of touch with reality. Where does this exist? But this is actually characteristic of Pope Francis. And I mean him no disrespect. Just talking as someone who has been in the media, look, I've covered the popes for 20 years and have been daily following them, had great opportunities to be with them in Rome. I've met Pope Francis personally. Our relationship in terms of a Vatican reportage is longstanding, and we're very thorough. We cover just about everything that is said and done, and that's a difficult task. But this confusion is not new here. This perception of, you know, this odd perception, this unrealistic perception, is characteristic of Pope Francis right from his beginning. Remember, in the first year of his papacy, he talked about, the first time on the plane returning from Brazil, he talked about how we can't talk about abortion, contraception, same-sex marriage all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He repeated the same thing in the first interview with Civiltà Cattolica, which is that Jesuit magazine run by Spadaro, who's his close friend. And again, he said, I've been criticized for not speaking about it much, but you can't talk about this all the time. And everybody in the pro-life movement, with which we're in touch with all over the world, wondered, where is this actually happening? Where are the priests pounding the pulpit Sunday after Sunday on these issues? Most of us have never, ever heard it. And all of the West, it's not only never heard of, you heard the opposite in your churches. But then we thought, and I'll show you some of my naivete here. Back when that was said in 2013, I thought, well, it must be Argentina. In Argentina, the priest must be pounding the pulpit every Sunday. And so, of course, we're connected to pro-life movements all over the world. So we called up our friends in Argentina and we said, wow, you guys have these priests that are just awesomely proclaiming the word of the truth on life, on family, even on contraception, just about daily, if not every Sunday. And it was silence and then a kind of snickering laughter, because, of course, in Argentina, it's exactly the same as in the West. In fact, some people say worse so. When Cardinal Bergoglio left, they only had 4 indigenous seminarians in their seminary. So that perception is off. It's off in a big way.
You know, that reminds me of a certain phrase that's used in the document, which is something to the effect that the Pope writes, communion is not a prize for the perfect. And something to that extent. And I thought to myself, whoever said that that's what communion is for? Or who's ever espoused that idea? And, I mean, when you read that within the context of the rest of the Pope's papacy, he says, if you're not like him, you're a Pelagian. You're indifferent to others. You're legalistic. You're rigid. And I don't know who he's talking about. I mean, is it rigid to uphold doctrine, centuries of teaching? I mean, there's all these sorts of straw men that are all over the place in this papacy. And but let's get into this document, you know, more so. The Pope was coming back from his trip to the island of Lesbos, and he was asked during the in-flight interview again on this plane. He said, look to Cardinal Schönborn of Austria for how to interpret this document. And Cardinal Schönborn has said this is a doctrinal development. Walter Kasper said it is as well. Clearly, this is a document that goes against not just tradition, but opens the door for communion for those in these sorts of divorced and so-called remarried situations.
Well, it certainly is that. And here's the thing. We had the key given to us during the synods. I was present at the synods as a reporter. We were allowed to interview some of the cardinals and bishops there, and LifeSite News has credentials at the Vatican. And so we actually had sometimes three, sometimes five reporters in the Sala Stampa, which is the sort of press office there. We were interviewing various cardinals. And so we had a sort of bird's eye view, if you will, of what was going on. And a very interesting key happened after the first synod, before the second. Cardinal Casper really let the cat out of the bag when he said that he figured that there wasn't enough support among the synod fathers for an outright going for what his proposal was. And so he said, what we need is language that everybody can accept. In other words, ambiguous language. He explained how this worked at the Second Vatican.
Non-Catholic language, in other words.
Exactly.
In reality.
Ambiguity, which lets anybody do anything they want.
Right.
And there is a problem because that is even stated, again, in one of the early parts of the encyclical. If you look to it in paragraph number 3, there's a very strange thing, and actually a juxtaposition, because at first the Holy Father says, I would make it clear that not all discussions of doctrine or moral practice need to be settled by interventions of the magisterium. So then, okay, wait a minute, that's a weird setup.
Yeah.
And then he said, of course, teaching and practice is certainly necessary. Unity of teaching and practice is necessary. But so that they seem almost contradictory, those statements. And then in the end of that paragraph, he says, each country or region, moreover, can seek solutions better suited to its culture and sensitive
that
to
its religious beliefs. That struck me. Yep.
That is the time bomb. That is the bomb called, as he put it in his first exhortation, I believe the words were giving genuine doctrinal authority to the bishops' conferences. In the middle of the synod, he called that meeting on the anniversary, 50th anniversary of the synods, where he surprised a lot of the synod fathers by talking about a need for a healthy decentralization.
Yep. Yep.
And that was huge. And here that comes again. And in effect, you see exactly that in the aftermath of Amoris Laetitia. You see bishops, cardinals even, interpreting it in the opposite way. So you have Archbishop Chaput who came out basically saying nothing's changed. You have the German cardinals, as you mentioned, saying that it's a whole new thing, it's a revolution. And you have other American cardinals like Supich, of course, saying this is a game changer. So you have the opposite interpretation. You have the horrific confusion, like Robert Royal mentioned in his piece on it. He's a great thinker in the church. He mentioned, you know, you're going to have in Poland faithfulness to the traditional teaching of the church, and yet across the border in Germany, you're going to have this new way forward for the church, which basically goes nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we're going to give you communion anywhere.
And that's what Cardinal Marx had said, I think, during the synod itself. He said, we're not a subsidiarity of Rome. You know, we are our own church. And this is a very, this is all right. You know, I spoke about this last week. I think Chris Ferrara mentioned, you know, if someone in Poland who is divorced and remarried wants to go to communion, they're just going to drive across the border, go right to Germany and say, hey, brand new church. And it fractures the church. It fractures the unity. And we look at, you know, the church as a one holy Catholic and apostolic church. I mean, what we're seeing is a divided, a regional, a political, and pastoral church that's going to be different everywhere. We're not unified anymore. And our language, I mean, this goes back further than just this synod, I think. I think it goes back to when, at Vatican II and in the 60s and 70s, we had a more, I mean, that's when they started decentralization and collegiality had begun. I mean, it was given up to the bishops' conferences to decide, as they did in America, to say, hey, we're not going to have year-round fasting of meat on Friday. We're going to have different things. And each church in each country has its own ethos. Instead of being a Roman Catholic Church, we have the American Catholic Church or the Canadian Catholic Church. And we have all sorts of different regional, values, right? And this is so utterly un-Catholic. And the other thing you mentioned, I wanted to get this in before I forget, was the language shift. And the thing that gets me the most is the term irregular union. I mean, this term papers over all the biblical language that we've ever known from the church, adultery, cohabitation, concubine. All these terms have been thrown under the bus, and we now have irregular union, this sort of inclusive modern language. Your thoughts on that term and your thoughts on the other results that will happen as a result of this document? What else can we look forward to in the years ahead?
Well, a couple things you said there really struck me. One, you were dead on when you said un-Catholic, because Catholic actually means universal. And so we are literally de-Catholicizing the church through that method. But with regard to irregular, there's something very interesting in the document. And it was pointed to actually by a liberal theologian by the name of Maloney in Italy. But if you look in the document at the word irregular, you'll notice that it has scare quotes around it almost constantly. So he talks about irregular marriages, but in there you will always see the scare quotes around irregular, which makes you think, what is the Holy Father actually saying? Is he saying that these should just be regarded as marriages because they're just quote unquote irregular? That's very concerning in and of itself. And so it makes one wonder, what exactly are we dealing with? The unclarity, the ambiguity here is such that it's open to everyone, including now having different ways forward. What we will see and what we are seeing is priests who want to remain faithful being badgered by not only their parishioners. They are going to be badgered by their parishioners. You're not Catholic like the Pope. Why aren't you being faithful to the Pope? But also by their bishops. When their bishops want to lean one way or don't want to be criticized for not following the Pope, they're going to pressure their priests to violate their consciences and do things that they really can't do. And so this is going to be a new persecution for priests themselves who want to remain faithful to Christ. And these are just by misinterpretations, let's say, of what's in the exhortation right now. So that's coming. But in addition to that, which is just on the sort of very inside of the church, there is also now the media presentation. You'll notice that in the media, all the leftists in the media, which is almost the whole of the media, there are very few actual particularly Catholic right-wing people in the media, but they're almost, to a man, just happily loving this. That talk I mentioned just recently where Ross Douthat was on, Ross Douthat is one of the only conservative Catholics in the media. He was at that, and all the other panelists were just lauding this exhortation, lauding Pope Francis. We've had, and we've seen this the whole way through. Do you remember when Nancy Pelosi, I think she was on 60 Minutes, and she was describing Pope Francis? She was literally in tears with joy over Pope Francis. And She was, her comment back to the, I believe it was 60 Minutes, but anyway, the interviewer said, yes, but there's some other Catholics who really are upset by this. And her response was, yes, but when the other guys were saying other stuff, we had to put up with it. Incredible.
Do you think this is going to shift conservative Catholics to a more, I don't know, traditional position and say, okay, maybe it's time, as we saw, and as you alluded to earlier, on EWTN, folks like Robert Royal, Raymond Arroyo, and Father Gerald Murray, who did a fairly courageous job. I mean, they're on EWTN, it's a mainstream public outlet. You know, they've been in the bosom of the bishops for quite some time. They came out pretty strongly against this document. Are we going to see more Catholics waking up to and finally recognizing their obligation to clarify this stuff? Because otherwise, you know, they're almost committing a sin of omission in my eyes when you're not calling attention to this and saying, look, it's the fact of the matter is the seeds of confusion are being sown, and they're being sown at the highest level of the church. Where do you see the Catholic media going? Where do you see, quite frankly, your obligation in all of this? Where do you see LifeSite News' role?
Another very good question. LifeSite News' motto has always been Caritas in Veritate. We basically provide the truth and love. We've gotten in some trouble sometimes for doing things, if you will, that way, because we don't believe that there is love without the truth. You see, I'm a revert to the faith. I abandoned the faith in my early teens and only came back in my early 20s. And it was from my father who basically told me the truth in love. He never let me get away with what I was doing. But he always told me that he loved me and that God loved me. And he knew I was acting in a way that was apart from God's love and God's will. And that helped me, because when I had my crisis, I could turn back to my dad and recognize, both in his faith and his constant exhortation to me to be faithful to the truth, the mercy of God. And today we were sued by a priest, by the way, in Canada, for pointing out, he said he was pro-choice and that he fought against the church's teaching on homosexuality. We did that not out of hatred, out of love for his parishioners, yes, but also for him, because we knew it was better for him to be disciplined than lead people down the false path, because our Lord did say that it would be better for them if a millstone be tied about their necks and they be cast into the sea than lead the little ones astray. And as far as I know, Jesus does not make styrofoam millstones. So, you know, what is our role then? What is our role as Catholics generally, our role at LifeSite News? It is to present the truth. We have seen the damage of ambiguity, of this type of thing, from Pope Francis now for 3 years. And where Catholics will go, there's a few directions. Some, unfortunately, will think to leave the faith. That has happened. I know of some people who've gone towards Orthodoxy.
I've heard that too. It's very common. Yep.
Know of some converts who are questioning what they did in light of what's going on. Those are very sad realities. There's another thing that people are doing. Some people, including some young priests I witnessed, are questioning their way of doing things and rearranging their minds and their understanding of the faith to reflect what they think is coming from Pope Francis. I watched some priests talk about how their approach to confession would change, how, you know, they weren't going to, you know, be as insistent upon things. And, you know, these aren't priests who were lacking in mercy before, but they're changing their understanding of truth. Close friend of mine who's a priest talked to me about being at a celebration with the old ladies of the parish, the ones who always understood the faith. And they were talking to him confusedly about homosexuality and what the new truth was or what the new situation in the church is. So there's massive confusion among the faithful themselves. So there's another reaction. And the third reaction, I think, is the one you mentioned. The one where people who know the truth and understand it will be emboldened now to get off the fence, to understand that the church is in crisis right now, and to roll up their sleeves and work. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the majority of those who are faithful. And I would repeat, actually, the words of Father Gerald Murray, because they were so strong and so important. And you were sort of quoting it yourself. He said the effort, I think, for all of us who are concerned, want to see happen, is to tell the Pope, flattery would mean we keep our mouths closed and say nothing. But gospel frankness calls us to say, Holy Father, either you've been poorly advised or you have an incomplete conception of this issue. And we know that we can share this information with you. And so in order to be a good Catholic right now, and he also, by the way, he quoted Canon 220, that all the faithful have the right to express their opinions about matters in church life, and that it's good that this be debated and even brought forward to the press. And really, that's what we do on LifeSite News, is to report the truth. When the exhortation came out, journalists get it early, of course. So unfortunately, it was released 6 a.m. Rome time. So, of course, that for us is like, I don't know, 8 a.m. Rome time, excuse me. It was our 2 a.m. I was just traveling home from the airport, got home at 2 a.m. and started But anyway, we had our report out at 6 a.m. after two of my colleagues had already finished it. And we've been discussing it ever since. So we try our best to present the truth in as clear a way as possible, in as charitable a way as possible. But that does not involve hiding the truth ever, even when it comes to having to present hard truths to the Holy Father, to bishops, to clergy. But we do so out of love for them, for the church, and to be true to Christ. That's really our only motivation.
Well, you know, I think you said it well, and that is the obligation of Catholics at all times. Charity in truth, I think that's something we do need to have more of. Because when our zeal gets bitter, I think it was, who was it, St. James, St. Jerome? He said it's not from above. You know, we need to have charity in that and being able to speak truth to power. And I think you guys are doing an excellent job, and I encourage all my listeners to go to lifesitenews.com to support you guys as well. And John Henry, thank you for being on. You're welcome back anytime on Church and State on Magnificat Radio.
Very good, Stephen. Good being with you, and God bless you and all your listeners.
Thank you very much, and we will be right back after this quick break. Folks, stick with us.